Hey there, web or podcast listeners. I'm Vermont Edition producer Matthew Smith, and I wanted to let you know that this podcast has been edited to make it a little bit shorter and a little bit sweeter. Thanks, and I hope you enjoy.
This is Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm. When I was a kid, my family used to ride the ferry across Lake Champlain between Shoreham, Vermont, and Ticonderoga, New York, pretty frequently. I think it might have been free if you weren't driving a car on, so it was a somewhat frequent diversion for when my dad was at loose ends with me and my brother. One time, I was probably 8 or 9-ish, I stood at the railing as we traveled back across the lake to Vermont after spending some time scrambling around the fort on the other side. I was twirling my ring and looking out at the shoreline. The ring was a special one. It had been my great aunt's, and it was given to me when she died. I stood there twirling it, lost in my own thoughts, and unthinking, spun it right off my finger, and plop, the ring fell out of my hand into the sparkling water of Lake Champlain. I was devastated in the way 9-year-olds can be, and so I consoled myself with a thought. Perhaps someday, when I was an adult and maybe more responsible with my things, I would ride the ferry again, and Champ, the lake monster everyone knew was swimming around in the depths of the Black Lake, would suddenly surface right next to the boat and lean forward toward me, and I would discover that he had my ruby ring clasped between his 2 sharp teeth, ready to give it back to me. Very silly, I know, but that little fantasy gave me solace for years. I'm sad to say it has not happened yet, but maybe someday. Now, plenty of people have had Champ sightings, going back centuries, in fact, and many other people have at least harbored a stray curious thought about the Champlain Lake Monster. So today on the show, we're going to talk a little bit about the origins of this Champ mythology and about the ecological conditions that do or do not support the idea of a large creature swimming around in Lake Champlain. We are joined for this discussion by Nina Ritabinho, Programs and Exhibits Director at Echo Lake Aquarium and Science Center, where they have a whole Champ exhibit, and Ellen Marsden, Wildlife and Fisheries Biology Professor at UVM. It's a pleasure to have you both with us for this show today. Thank you.
Pleasure to be here. Thank you.
Thrilled to be here.
We've been waiting to do this for a long time, so we're excited to talk Champ with both of you. And Nina, maybe you can start us off. I can't imagine there's anybody listening to the radio today who does not know exactly who Champ is, but for those who may be unfamiliar, who's Champ?
So Champ is a legendary lake monster who stalks Lake Champlain, generally believed today to be a benevolent creature who brings joy and occasionally ruby rings to, it seems like, adults
I hope.
Adults only.
I'm 40. It could still happen. So benevolent now, not always seen to be benevolent?
In Champ's earlier days, before Champ was even called Champ, Champ was believed to be more menacing. And there were reports of Champ stealing cattle from people's farms. It was described as having red eyes, scintillating silver scales, and was much more of a supernatural classic monster living in the lake.
So Champ could come on land to steal cattle?
In the late 1800s, generally reports were that Champ was going onto land and maybe even living in caves and then could move between the water and the land.
So Dennis wrote in and is wondering, is there anyone who can be kind of credited with the first mention of the legend? And did the concept exist in Native American lore?
So the concept of a great serpent existed in both the Abenaki and the Iroquois communities. And the idea of a great serpent really exists almost across all Native American cultures in North America. To say that's continuous with the Lake Champlain sea monster as we talk about it today, it's hard to draw that line. So the earliest written reports are really in the early 1800s. Sometimes Samuel de Champlain is credited with seeing a monster, but that idea has really been debunked. And was
because he didn't see the monster or because it wasn't in Lake Champlain?
Both. So it was misreported in a 1970 Vermont Life article. And the description was very different from what's actually in Champlain's journals. So the Vermont Life article describes something really serpent-like, very large. And in Champlain's actual journals, he's describing something that's about 5 feet, not really monstrous, and very similar to a garfish.
Womp womp.
Yeah.
Kayla emailed in to say, I have yet to spot Champ, but we regularly keep watch from the air. I teach paragliding and put on clinics for intermediate pilots where we tow up over Lake Champlain using a boat and a special winch in order to practice maneuvers like spirals and stalls in a safe environment over the water. We launch the pilots from the beach at Bulwaga Bay, just north of Crown Point Bridge. The paraglider pilots get a great view of the lake in the area where Champ is said to be most active. All right, so still hoping that some of the paragliders can see Champ. And if you have seen Champ, give us a call. Our number is 800-639-2211. That's 1-800-639-2211. Or you can email vermontedition@vpr.org. Ellen Marsden, so Nina was telling us who Champ is, the legend. Who is Champ, perhaps the creature? I mean, what's the theory anyway about what Champ might be if it is real?
Champ is usually conveyed as something that looks like and is often identified as a plesiosaur. And Champ is similar in that respect to many other monsters, the Loch Ness monster, for example, the monster in Loch Lochy, etc. Something with a long neck and a large head that comes out of the water. It's got humps behind it. So serpentine perhaps behind or just one hump. That makes it an air breather. Because nothing that's truly an aquatic organism has, the breeze with gills has a neck. It doesn't need a neck. There's no vision of gills. But the last plesiosaur fossil was about 66 million years ago. And the oldest organism we know of any type is about 5,000 years old, and that's a tree.
You mean living, current,
living,
still alive.
That's still alive, right. So the longevity that we know of is no more than about 5,000 years. So it does.
And that's a tree, you were saying.
And that
I interrupted
was a
you.
Tree that tend to live a little longer than animals. So it boggles our comprehension a little bit that it is what it's perceived to be, which is this air-breathing residue of the dinosaur age.
Well, but couldn't there just be a breeding population of plesiosaurs? I mean, it doesn't have to be 66 million years old.
Absolutely. And we do tend to talk about Champ as singular, but we can't have a single 66 million year old organism. So yeah, a breeding population, but that means that there have to be enough to sustain a population. And everything we know about biology says long-term population, about 5,000. Right. Now, it's an air breather, so it's going to have to surface to get air. Again, the longest known air breather can hold its breath for maybe 4 or 5 hours at a pinch. So it's surfacing 4 to 6 to 12 times a day. And if there's 5,000 of them doing that, we really ought to see it more often. And in fact, what's unique about it was specialized to all these monsters is they are very rarely seen, you know, every few years or decades. And they're very large, right? By definition, it wouldn't be a monster if it wasn't large. If it was 5 feet, it would just be something interesting, not amazing. So, yeah, an air-breathing population does boggle our comprehension a bit.
All right. So, plus, plesiosaurs were sea creatures who lived in salt water?
Absolutely. All of the monsters tend to be freshwater. Again, Loch Ness and Memphrey and Champlain, partly because the shoreline is closer, so there's more chance of observing things. And I think mariners had their own, the open ocean mariners, they had lots of monsters. But mm-hmm. then there are very, very large organisms that can be monsters out there if you don't know what it is you're looking at. But yes, saltwater creatures don't do well in freshwater. So the chances that it's a dinosaur coming in from saltwater, unlikely.
All right. So if it's not a dinosaur, but it is a real creature, what might it be?
We can go two ways there. It could be a saltwater organism that wandered in, hasn't died yet from osmotic stress from being in freshwater. Things like oarfish, they grow to 15, 20 feet. They're serpentine. They're monstrous looking. They've got mane, sort of a red mane of fin behind them. So accidentals, shall we say. Or they're observations by people with, you know, they're startling. They haven't seen anything like it before. It's under unusual conditions. They're not stopping to be analytical about it, often in conditions which frighten somebody. It's at dark, it's at night in the fog. We often, while we're out on the lake doing research, engage in what we call Champ sightings. Three humps moving steadily through the water on a flat, calm day in the bright sunlight. You go, wow, there it goes. It's very clear to see. It's wakes. It's a boat that went by 15 minutes ago, and that's the residual wake moving in three apparent humps across the lake. Very common. Spring, we get a lot of logs coming in from both sides of the lake being washed downstream, and we can get some wonderful champ mimics. They're big rolling thing with humps behind it and a branch that comes out that looks like something monstrous. A little bit of fog really helps, and you've got a monster.
We got a note from House Crow who says, I've seen a mother otter and one or two of her children swimming in a line, rising above and diving below the surface in a classic sea monster shape, which I'm certain an uninformed person from the shore could think was a sea monster. I've seen floating logs with dragon-like heads that really looked like swimming dragons until I had paddled within a few yards. Moose and deer regularly swim across the lake and from a distance are difficult to identify. No one likes a party pooper. But the problem with a belief in mythical creatures is that we ignore real ones that are just as interesting. Nina, what do you hear about the sightings, the modern-day sightings of champ? And who's seeing champ? And, you know, how do those sightings sort of appear and become part of our culture?
Well, there are lots of recorded sightings. You'll see them on the sign at Blawaga Bay. There hasn't been an agency that has systematically recorded all of the sightings of champ. SUNY Plattsburgh did it for a while, Champ Quest in the 90s, and now Champ Search collects sightings from folks. There's a lot of unreported sightings, and I know this because I see them every day at Echo. So just on Friday, there was a child looking out in the water who saw Champy. And so I think if you go to a bar, you will hear a champ story from someone in that bar. So there's a lot of unreported sightings going on. That being said, we do occasionally get videos at Echo. We've gotten a couple otter videos of folks who've asked if that otter was maybe champ or that school of otters.
When I was a kid, again, in elementary school, I think we had show and tell once a week. And every week during show and tell, somebody had a picture or, you know, a VHS video cassette that they had done. And it was like, you know, me and my dad were fishing and we saw champ and here's a picture and it's grainy and something is on the picture. And, you know, it's a wonderful thing in some ways to be able to have that fantasy, whether you really believe it or not, because what fun to think there could be something mysterious in the lake. And so few things are mysteries these days. And Nita Rinabinho, I imagine that for a lot of people, it just is sort of a fun imaginary thing to half believe.
Yeah, and I think the other perspective is that it doesn't really take away, but it amplifies people's interest in the other animals in Lake Champlain. Champ is really an umbrella species, the same way that a panda is, that is an ambassador for these majestic, beautiful animals that live in our lake. Dennis Hall of Champ Quest, he was a huge champ hunter, but he was also an advocate for stewarding the lake, both for champ and all the other animals that live in Lake Champlain.
So you're saying champ is one of those megafauna species that help us conserve all of the other ones,
too? Champ is the biggest charismatic megafauna out there.
Ellen Marston, do you agree that there's no harm, really, in having champ as part of our lore?
I agree completely. It makes Lake Champlain even more interesting, interests tourists. They want to spend more time on near the lake. The kids get interested. Absolutely. It's an ambassador for the ecology of the lake.
So even as a scientist, you're not bothered by the fact that none of the scientific theories that you can come up with would support even a modicum of hope that champ is real.
There's nothing wrong with a great mythology and something to thrill the kids and get interested in and spend more time observing. And then perhaps we insert a little bit of logic there about what it's not, like a plesiosaur, and start thinking about what it could be. And then
Sturgeon,
absolutely. Or carp. Again, large groups of large fish roiling around in the water like the otters playing can suddenly transform into a monster. And that's exciting. That's great.
Let's go to Kermit, who's calling in from Wyndham. Hi, Kermit. You're on the air.
Hi. Really quick here. Very skeptical about these kinds of things, but I study biogeography, taxonomy, these kinds of things. And a friend of mine, who I went to school with, saw something in the south of Burlington and in Lake Champlain, the southern part, and was completely skeptical until he saw what he saw. I'm going to skip ahead and just say, here's what I think, based on what his experience was. Both of us studied a mammal called the Desmond, which is endemic to Lake Baikal. It's an aquatic insectivore. I'm thinking, perhaps, that these creatures are related to whales. Hippos and whales are actually closely related, we find out, through their DNA. So, you know, some creature that is more related to their common ancestor, and it is a subterranean lake-dwelling creature with a very long proboscis, which does its feeling for it, and so when it surfaces from one of these underground lakes, glacier lakes and what have you, its proboscis is what people see and assume that it's a neck and head.
Hmm. And Kermit, do you really think that there are those creatures in Lake Champlain, or are you scratching around for some answer that would satisfy the believers?
You know, I was completely just thought it was ridiculous. And then this friend of mine who saw this thing, who's even a bigger skeptic than I am, he saw what he thought was a whale. And but the thing about it that really struck him is he could barely see. They were diving. But he saw this leg that was almost like a frog, and it reminded him immediately of this creature called the Desmond. And it is a really strange creature. If you look at it, you'll get where he's coming from. It's a nocturnal creature that swims about, and it has kind of frog hind legs, and it really doesn't use its eyes very much. And we don't know much about the these lakes. And, you know, this whole hemisphere was covered, or the northern part of the hemisphere was covered in ice sheets. There are lakes underneath glaciers that still exist.
Well, Kermit, and it sounds fascinating. And in fact, you know, maybe even more interesting to study this idea that there could be something under there. Before we come back to our guests, I want to get a couple more thoughts in here. Mike is calling in from Johnson. Mike, hi. Nice to talk with you. Hey, Mike, you there?
Yes, I am.
All right. What about you? Have you had a sighting?
Pretty sure that I have. I was road testing a car in September of 96, rather. I've never reported this really to anybody. Drove down to Red Rocks Park, and as I came in, I looked in the bay. There's several fishermen, and there appeared to be what looked like an overturned boat with some sort of bird at one end of it. When I turned the car around, it was gone. I have a background in biology. I have led nature watches on the Lamoille River. And, I can't explain it away from anything other than it being some sort of creature that we haven't identified.
Mike, wow, so cool to hear about your sighting. And, you know, that moment of thinking, did I just see what I think I just saw. I appreciate you sharing that with us, an exclusive here for Vermont Edition, since you've never shared it with anyone. Another thought in here from John in Brattleboro. John, hi, go right ahead.
Hi, are you there?
Yeah, we can hear you.
Okay, good. I'm sorry, I had to take my phone off the speaker. No, I just wanted to say that, relay just a quick, cute story for you and our listeners. In 1992, we were fishing Lake Champlain, and we caught a fish that was so big. We had a 20-foot sea nymph, a deep lake trolling boat, and we had to stop the boat, you know, a little bit about fishing, in order to not snap the line because the fish was so big. And in a very short amount of time, in a minute or two, whatever it was that we caught started pulling our boat backwards. And the boat itself, with a full tank of gas, weighs close to 4,000 pounds. So we figured that it was probably a sturgeon. But the only thing that I wanted to add is that I think maybe the weak link is the St. Lawrence Seaway. God only knows what, you know, potentially could come in and out of that lake from the Atlantic or elsewhere on the planet.
Yeah.
It's a little bit of a mystery that gives a little bit of credence to this story, although I don't believe it, but that's why I mentioned the St. Lawrence Seaway, is because, you know, you just never really know, and it would be the coolest thing if there was something prehistoric or ocean-dwelling in our little crown jewel of the Northeast, Lake Champlain.
It sure would be, John, and that's an interesting perspective. And I can hear you just trying for, you know, something that would let you have a little bit of belief. But Ellen Marson, not to pour hot water on that idea, but is it still possible for things to sort of climb into Lake Champlain from the St. Lawrence Seaway?
It's a little harder than it used to be because 10,000 years ago, of course, we were a direct connection. And since then, the glacial uplift or the bounce after glaciers has made the entrance shallower. So at low water, you'd have to be pretty small to get through the rapids. At high water, you've got to be pretty tough to get through the flowing water. But certainly seals have been seen in the lake, and a big seal could do the type of boat towing he's talking about. And seals can get pretty big, and again, with the wrong scale or looked at the wrong way, can be pretty monstrous.
I think I would find it pretty, not alarming, but amazing and weird if I saw a seal in Lake Champlain.
Absolutely. And I'll say one more thing about many of these suggestions, which I love to think there might be something out there we've never seen before. That'd be great. But let's be analytical about it. And I'll credit this actually to Rick Sungeri. The lake freezes over, and it used to freeze over much more often than it does. If you're an air breather, that poses a problem. How do you get back to the surface to get air? Even caves, there's going to be limited air in there for the 5 months. Sorry, 3 months maybe, that it might be locked in. So we've got to tackle that problem if we've got an air breather.
Rick Sungeri, analytical mind here at VPR, again, you know, just ruining everything for everyone. We are talking today about CHAMP. We're learning a little bit about the origins of the CHAMP mythology, and we're getting some insight into the specific ecological conditions that could sustain a population of plesiosaurs. Here's Plattsburgh folk musician Stan Ransom, who's known as the Connecticut Peddler, from his album Songs of Lake Champlain.
We see him come out in the springtime. As soon as the lake is unfroze, he gives us a scare, popping up here and there after his long winter doze. Here's to our Lake Champlain monster, the king of the deep and the damp. We'll sing one more chorus to our dinosaurus, that lovable creature named Champ.
See, even the Connecticut peddler Stan Ransom thinks that there's some way that it's surviving through the ice. That's his song, Champ. And in a new collection book by author Joe Hill called Full Throttle, you'll find a short story by the silver water of Lake Champlain that continues the legend of Champ. I'm Jane Lindholm, and this is Vermont Edition. Today we're talking about Champ and other lake monsters, too, like Memphrey in Memphremagog and Willie in Lake Willoughby, of course. We're talking today with Nina Ritabinho, Programs and Exhibits Director at Echo Lake Aquarium and Science Center, and Ellen Marsden, Wildlife and Fisheries Biology Professor at UVM. Safe to say, Ellen Marsden is not a believer, but would like to. Nina, are you a believer?
I would love to believe, and I also really enjoy the mystery. So I'm sort of hoping that we never really bring a conclusion to this story.
So you're a CHAMP agnostic?
Yeah.
All right. Okay. Let's go to Jim in North Hero. Jim, hi. You're on the air.
So one day I was crossing Rouses Point Bridge late afternoon on a calm day, and I was convinced that I saw CHAMP. There were these very high peaks on the back, moving in a very straight line, and I thought, that's no conventional boat wake. And it fascinated me so much, I had to pull over and try and figure out what was going on. And my conclusion was, there were probably two boats that had gone under the bridge in parallel, moving in the same direction. And what happened was then the two boat wakes, as your guest suggested, it was a boat wake, but this was much more. It was two boat wakes that came together, and so the peaks get higher and the troughs get lower, and also the way the wakes follow behind the boats, these peaks were following in a very straight line. But it was really remarkable. I could then understand why people really believe they saw CHAMP, because it was absolutely like the pictures except for the neck.
And if you hadn't figured out that it was the boats, would you have gone there, Jim?
The boats were nowhere to be seen. I guess it's having spent 60 years on the lake in boats that I could slowly figure out what was going on. But I'm like your other guest. I'm agnostic. I'm still waiting.
Good. Well, maybe all of us will someday get our CHAMP fantasy, whether there is a ring attached to it or not. You know, it's not just CHAMP, though. As we've been talking about this, there are other lake monsters and even other lake monsters in Vermont. There's Willie in Lake Willoughby and Memphremagog, who you could call Memphrey or Memphrey, depending on which side of the U.S.-Canadian border you fall on. Barbara Malloy lives in Newport, and she's had multiple Memphrey sightings, and she joins us now. Barbara, nice to have you on the program.
Yeah, well, thank you for inviting me.
So can you tell us about at least one of your sightings of Memphrey, how you saw Memphrey, how you figured out, I think that's Memphrey, and, you know, what was happening?
Well, I've had, I'm up to 180 sightings that I documented, and I've done over 50 myself, and I think the sightings were the same as the one that I've seen several times. And I think it's important that I bring up the fact that this plesiosaurus reptile resembles the characteristics, your professor there got it right. It is an air-breathing plesiosaurus reptile because I had the nostrils on the face documented. And the characteristics of this is a horse-shaped head, long neck, big brown eyes, humps, coils, and it has nostrils. It's been seen up that close. Smiley face, and it also a lot of things that people don't realize. This animal has the front and back modified paddles. Everything has been documented with verified documentations of sightings of facts and truth in my files. And the anatomy is, this animal is over 50 feet, and it could be, adult would be. It's shiny, and it's black, and it swims fast. It can sink, and it also has a communication noise. And it can be both playful and friendly. And it has been seen at numerous times traveling in pairs. So we know there's a family lives here in Lake Memphremagog. And it is my belief, after all my years of 30-some years of scientific documentation, that this aquatic creature came in from the Atlantic Ocean. And how it got into Lake Memphremagog, most likely through Owl's Head Mountain in the Canadian waters. And I know I do have quite a few sightings of Willie and all the other lakes, Seymour Lake up here. But I think, getting back, my earliest sighting is documented in 1816 in diaries of 4 sightings and 4 people. And
but Barbara, what about you? I want to hear when you first saw
it. I had my first sighting in August of 1983, and I was overlooking the lake with my 2 daughters. And it was incredible. I could see this big black thing coming in from the Canadian border near the islands. And at that time, there was jet skiers on the lake, and I thought that's what it was. But when we got out of the car to look, it turned sideways. And you can see down the hill into the water that this big, long, dark thing was moving under the water. And it actually had a horse-shaped head and neck above the water. And it was humping at its shoulders. And, of course, in 1983, people weren't talking about. We heard rumors there was a sea serpent in the lake, because I only moved here in 1978. And then it turned and went out into the middle of the lake, and because it was raining earlier, we lost it in the mist. And from that day, I got very lucky, because a few days later, in our local newspaper, a man named Jacques Beauvert in Magog, Quebec, Canada, was writing about the lake, its history, and if you've seen anything strange in the lake. So I jumped on it. I called him, and from that day forward, we were very good Canadian colleagues. And that was my first sighting. But I have had numerous ones, and I don't know why I'm the chosen one around here to see all these. But my last one is unbelievable. It was right here in the city of Newport, in Gardner Park, they call it, and it had a big shiny black hump on top of the water in 2003. And would you believe it? It has an eerie feeling because nobody was coming behind me or in front of me over the little bridge that goes into Newport. But the important thing is, the time I got home, I didn't have my camera. I ran home to get my camera. The time I got home, my husband's all excited. He says, "Someone just saw a Memphrey." I says, "You're kidding me." And what the animal did, our little Memphrey, it went out underneath the Long Bridge here in Newport and down into the South Bay. And this lady saw it coming. She was outside washing her windows. So that made me feel more confident that I knew what I was looking at.
Yeah. Well, Barbara, I appreciate you sharing your sightings with us and your documentation of Memphrey. Barbara Molloy lives in Newport. She's had multiple Memphrey sightings, and she has documented many, many more. Barbara, thanks again. Nice to talk with you.
Okay. Well, thank you.
We're talking mostly about Champ, but also Champ's cousins, brothers, sisters, maybe, in other Vermont lakes. So Memphrey is one. Willie is another. Let's go to John, who's calling in from Lake Placid. John, hi. You have a Champ sighting?
Well, I have a sighting that you can decide whether it was Champ or not.
All right.
Here's what happened. I was driving to college in 2002 along Route 9, which is right on the shore of Lake Champlain on the New York side. Going up, it was perfectly glass water, not a speck of ripple, nothing. It was perfectly glass. Along that stretch, about 200 to 300 yards out, is an island called Gunboat Island. Just off the south of Gunboat Island, there were two what looked like, at that distance, 55-gallon drums. But they were moving. They were moving around. They were like a swimming pit. One would have come up a little bit more, and the other one would come up down and get a little bit more that was bobbing around out there. This went on for about 3 or 4 minutes, and then all of a sudden disappeared completely. No swimming away, no rip book, nothing. They just disappeared and went under. Now, you tell me what it was.
Well, I don't know, John, but I like your sighting. I like the idea of it. Ellen Marson, what do you think it is?
Based on the size and behavior, it could be carp. They can get fish, you have to like grow indefinitely. So unless they die of predation or old age or something like that, they can, individuals can get extraordinarily large. Spawning carp will come close to shore. They'll start to roil around at the surface. So to have two, I'd be surprised there were only two, would certainly have a behavior like that. And they could appear close to a 55-gallon drum from a distance where the scale is a little harder to make out.
So Katie Elizabeth is a cryptozoologist, and Katie runs Champ Search. She's been researching Champ for over 25 years. Katie is on the line with us now. Hi, Katie. Nice to talk with you.
Very nice to speak with you as well. I'm really excited you guys are doing a story on Champ. It's about time.
Yes, we've been waiting and very eager to talk Champ. So, you know, what made you think that not only is Champ real, potentially, but that it's something worth spending 25 years searching for and trying to document and trying to prove?
Well, that's actually a good question, because a lot of people that I meet, they're like, oh, you're crazy. I'm like, okay, that's, you know, everybody has their own calling in life. And I started my fascination with Champ when I was 7. I saw an episode of Unsolved Mysteries, and I saw the famous Nancy photo that was taken in 1977. I said to my mom, I want to go to Lake Champlain. There's a dinosaur there. That's what I told her. And she says, are you crazy? And she said, well, pull out the old Rand McNally map, which I did. And it was 5 hours away from my home state of Rhode Island. So it wasn't until 2012, after years of just reading about Champ and Nessie and other lake creatures around the world, that I actually came up here for a trip. And my second day here, and this is what amazes me, I had my first sighting. Now, I grew up in the ocean state. I also have a biology background, and I know what I saw was not a sturgeon. I'm sure that many sightings are misidentifications. It can be easily, you know, you see a boat wake, oh, there's Champ, 100-foot-long monster. And the problem with the stories of Champ over the years, they've been elaborated to where there's this 100-foot-long monster in the lake, and you always see the head and neck. And unfortunately, that's not what they look like. I have seen the head and neck one time. I also have videos of these animals as well as echolocation recordings. I know for a fact myself that there's something here. I wouldn't have moved here and dedicated everything to trying to prove this. The most important thing for me is protection for these animals. You know, the plesiosaur idea, as Ms. Marsden said, she hit the nail on the head. The problem is, yes, our lake does freeze over on occasion. So how would these animals, breathing mm-hmm. when the lake freezes over? And also, the other question, too, is, you know, why aren't, you know, if they're air breathers, why aren't we seeing them all the time? Because that would be the case.
So what's your theory?
My theory is that, you know, since this is an ancient area and it goes back to the Champlain Sea 10 to 12,000 years ago, that possibly, and not in the known fossil record, unfortunately, and I hope one day we do find something, that this is an amphibious species, an unknown long-necked amphibian. Because that way, you know, amphibians do not need to come up for air all the time. They can breathe through their skin.
Right, and they can hibernate.
Probably.
Yeah.
Oh, absolutely. And you know, the wintertime survival, people ask me all the time, what do you think they do in the winter? Well, an ectothermic animal, which I believe a lot of people say reptile or amphibian. I'm not sure I'm on the fence with either a theory, but I really do believe that this is an amphibious species. It could be a hybrid of some sort. I don't know. But, you know, breathing through their skin makes sense. And it's an amazing thing to think about. And like I said, over the years, it's been elaborated into kind of a joke, unfortunately.
Well, Katie, Katie, let me play the echolocation sound that you sent us,
okay. Because
you mentioned you have a recording, and I want you to tell us what you think we're hearing. So first of all, here's the sound. Okay, so Katie, how did you record that, and what do you think it is?
This was in July of 2014. I was down in an area with my partner, Dennis Hall, who ran Champ Quest. We were out on the lake around 7:30 p.m., and he had gotten a video back in 1985. Not a very good video, because cameras back then were not that great. But we went to this location because there's been a lot of sightings there, and I dropped my hydrophone in the water. Like I said, I do have a biology background. I'm also an angler on the lake. Every day I go fishing in the morning, and then the rest of the day I look for champ. And, you know, you have to have a trained eye, because people, like I said, are looking for this 100-foot-long monster, and that's not, in fact, what they look like. So I think, you know, somebody from the city that's never really been on the water, that doesn't have a background in biology, they'll see a sturgeon, which I've seen sturgeon, I've seen whales, I've seen dolphins, you name it. I think when you know and you have that biology background, that's very important for identification, of course.
Yeah, so Katie, the sound.
We were recording out at this area called Scotch Bonnet, and I believe that these animals use echolocation to find food and to navigate the lake. And unfortunately, with the blue-green algae blooms in the lake, the visibility can be quite poor during the summer months when these animals are seen. So I think that is what they use that for. But I believe that they also have other types of communication. I do record sturgeon sounds, sturgeon thunder, as they call it, boat motors, man-made sounds, fish finders, stuff like that. Does not fit into this category of sounds that I've recorded.
Wow. Well, it's really cool to hear and really interesting to hear about your research. Katie Elizabeth is a cryptozoologist. She runs Champ Search. Katie, thank you for talking with us today.
It was so great to be on the show. I really appreciate being on.
Well, we loved having you, and we are going to keep talking about Champ, where we have more sightings, more theories, and more from our guests, Nina Ritabinho from ECHO and Ellen Marsden, a biology professor at UVM. You're listening to Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm, and today we're talking about Champ, the legendary lake monster of Lake Champlain. We've also been talking a little bit about Memphrey, and Willie is a similarly described sea monster, lake monster in Lake Willoughby. We're talking with Ellen Marsden, a wildlife and fisheries biology professor at UVM, and Nina Ritabinho, programs and exhibits director at Echo Lake Aquarium and Science Center, right on the shores of Lake Champlain. So if anybody should see Champ, it's probably Nina. We were talking earlier with Katie Elizabeth, who's a cryptozoologist who has documented Champ. And Katie said the thing that first got her inspired to look for Champ was what she called the Mansi photograph. Mm-hmm. And this is the most famous photograph of Champ. And Nina, you actually brought the photograph. Can you describe it? Because we have a link to it on our webpage, but we can't put it right up on our page.
Yes. So this is the actual authentic Mansi photo. It was taken in 1977 by Sandra Mansi. It's a very small photo. It's about the size of a Polaroid photo. In the very center, we see a figure. The figure has a single hump. It appears to have a long neck that's turned to the right. That's about what we can see in the photo.
Why did this captivate people so much?
It's a pretty striking photo when you look at it. When I look at it, I immediately think of a brontosaurus perhaps wading in the water. It's definitely has a clear animal-like image. It looks like it has, it's animated in some way. And I think it speaks to sort of the famous photo of the Loch Ness Monster from the 1930s. Very similar appearance, except for that one turned out to be a hoax.
Yes, unfortunately.
Unfortunately.
But Nina, you know, today, so many of us carry our cameras with us every single place we go because we have cell phones. And, you know, we're still sort of looking at this old photograph, mm-hmm. an old grainy photograph that can't really be blown up because it was, you know, older equipment. It was a small picture. Why do we not have the, like, glossy, new, super high pixelated version of this photo to intrigue us, do you think?
I don't know. There are lots of videos online, lots of photos online that you can go see, but they do tend to be pretty grainy, pretty open to interpretation. But I really like something that Joseph Zirinsky once said. He was a big advocate of the Manzis, wrote a book about Champ, and that was that a cryptid belongs to all of us. And when a cryptid is confirmed to be true, then it belongs to the zoologist. Mm. So I sort of like this idea that maybe we don't want Champ to be discovered because he belongs to all of us right now.
Well, Ellen Marsden, what do you think? I mean, presumably you have the technology. What do you think about why we don't have, I mean, it's similar thing to catamounts. Why don't we have more confirmed sightings and bones or, you know, why do people still believe, do you think, if in the absence of this really highly documented sort of trail?
The absence of technology in the past is what made this so very mysterious. Somebody takes a grainy photograph or they have a memory. And of course, we know our memory is fallible and it becomes mythology, and especially with a bit of fear or excitement involved, and suddenly it's twice as long, five times as big, etc. But you're absolutely right. We not only, everybody has a cell phone at this point, but we have GoPros, we have underwater cameras that anybody can buy. And as Katie Elizabeth said, now we have hydrophones. And certainly in a different branch in the sciences, we're finding that as we put hydrophones down more and we put them where lake trout are spawning or sturgeon are spawning, we're finding out that it's not just fish like drum or croaker that make noises that give them their names. We've known those for centuries, but now we're finding lots of organisms are making sounds. So we can document. We just need to spend, you know, if we're really excited about this and interested in pursuing cryptozoology, spend concerted time trying to document these sightings. As it is, I like the idea that let's leave it mysterious and it gives the excitement. If we document it, it becomes too mundane.
I don't believe you really believe that, though. If you really thought that Champ was out there and you were saying, but let's not document it, what kind of scientist would you be?
A bad one.
AK emailed in to say Lake Champlain is home to the oldest coral reef in the world, after all, the Chazy Reef. Perhaps these dinosaurs or some larger creatures were there at the end of the 19th century and have passed away. We do know the Greenland sharks live over 200 years. So lots of people having lots of different ideas. And, you know, Nina Ritabinho, why is this something, you know, that ECHO preserves the idea of, that we still think about in our modern culture, even, you know, as we're talking about with Professor Marsden, this idea that, you know, we don't have all of this really good documentation, but we still have this idea that this is part of who we are. And some people love it, some people hate it, some people think it's ridiculous, some people are true believers. And it's still sort of part of who we are as Vermonters to believe in these lake monsters.
Yeah, and I think it's part of who we are as humans across the world to create these myths, this storytelling, to make explanations of the world. And these monsters are often reflections of ourselves and our values and our beliefs. And so right now, I like to think that Champ reflects our belief in stewarding the lake and stewarding our environment, and has been protected by the legislatures in both New York and Vermont. And so that, you know,
Champ has.
Yes. So both officially protected. And I think that reflects our values as Vermonters.
So do you think we'll ever have definitive proof or lack thereof to say, nope, not real?
I hope not. And science is really about curiosity and debate. And I think in that regards, CHAMP is really sort of a scientific conversation mixed in with a little bit of fun.
Ellen Marsden, what do you think?
And I would say, as a scientist, I don't at all disagree with Nina, but to identify it and say, oh, it's this, that is part of the excitement from the scientific standpoint, to give it a taxonomic name and understand where it came from and its background and its ecology.
Well, in the meantime, it's wonderful to think about CHAMP, and I appreciate both of you spending the hour thinking about CHAMP with us. Ellen Marsden is a wildlife and fisheries biology professor at UVM. Nina Ritabinho is programs and exhibits director at ECHO Lake Aquarium and Science Center. Thanks very much to both of you.